You're listening to episode 3 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. We talk about technology, talk about GNU, Linux, Unix, BSD, Illumos. In this episode, it's not going to be a super technical episode. It is going to be, well, sort of what I'm calling the teaching episode, because there's a lot of stuff about GNU specifically that I think a lot of us either take for granted or don't understand or need to talk about in some way. And a lot of it pertains to how to get information out there into the world. And that's what I want to tackle today. So if you heard about GNU World Order because I have lots of bash and lots of code and stuff like that, this isn't that episode. This is the other episode. You can listen to last episode and the episode before that and get lots of cool information about UDev and bash and stuff like that. In this episode, we're talking about our job as free software enthusiasts and what that means. So let's start talking. Hold your horses. I know you want to start talking about this, especially since I said, let's start talking. But actually, if you know this show at all, and I know you do, first up is listener feedback. And I don't have that much, again, listener feedback, because, again, I am recording this in advance. This one way in advance, because I know that in a couple of weeks, I am going to Ohio Linux Fest. You will, by the time you've heard this, it'll already have been passed. So I'm doing this pretty far in advance. I really haven't had time to get any listener feedback from episodes. But there's one episode that, there's one listener feedback that I do want to mention because it's really, really cool and fairly apropos to this discussion. It was from Ron. Ron has emailed me many times in the past about lots of different things, and this one was particularly of interest because at my job I was just about to start a lot of routine maintenance on a lot of computers, which means a lot of me sitting around waiting for things to install and waiting for things to image and whatever. So the fact that Ron sent me this particular email was very good because it contained a link to a very informative site full of videos that I could watch. And the video site in question is audio-video.gnu.org/video/ghm2013. Now, if you've been to gnu.org any time in the past couple of months, then you'll know that at the top of the screen, at the top of the page, there has been this banner saying the GNU Hackers Meeting, Paris, France, 7th Annual. And I really, really kind of wanted to go. Like, honestly, I really wanted to go. I thought that would be super cool, but justifying a trip to France for a GNU Hackers Meeting when I'm not really that much a hacker. I mean, I'm not a GNU hacker. You know, I mean, I am, but I'm not. You know what I mean? So I thought, well, that's a lot of money and a lot of time to go to something that I would really only be sitting around at, having a lot of fun and being informed about a lot of cool things. Okay, I should have gone. Point is, I didn't, and that doesn't matter because the videos and the audio and the slides are all online at audio-video.gnu.org/video/ghm2013. They're WebM videos, so you can watch them on a free system without any problem at all. It's kind of nice. And it's got amazing videos. It's got some amazing content. You will be entertained for a few hours. There's a lot of short talks, so some of the content that you'll be watching is not really that long. But there is an amazing talk about something called Geux, G-U-I-X, which is a package management system that GNU has kind of started, and it's going to be sort of a distribution method for GNU packages. I don't really know yet how it's going to manifest itself or how they want it to manifest. I mean, that is it going to be in its own distribution or what? Another really amazing one is GNS, which is the GNU name system. So you've heard of DNS. Get ready for GNU-NS, which is a decentralized, obviously completely free from censorship, essentially a DNS system, which sounds pretty amazing and really underscores a lot about GNU that I think is really, really important. I feel like a lot of us don't really, I mean, like a lot of us have this sense about the GNU organization like the FSF and that movement as well. Yes, it's a very important thing. It's necessary. You know, we want those hardcore people out there pushing for the extreme, and that's important. And isn't it nice that they exist? And that's the summation of our feelings on it. That if those are your feelings on it, then there is actually a talk that kind of talks about that addresses that very issue. So you're in luck, and you could go watch that at your leisure. I've got some things about that as well to say, but I'll save that for later in the show, because that's kind of a lot of what I'll be talking about anyway. So that was a great email from Ron. Thank you very much, Ron, for the email. And I think we can now start talking about the things that we're going to start talking about. Fairly recently, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of teaching, which I do normally anyway. I teach regularly classes on beginning filmmaking and things like that. Fairly recently, a friend of mine who happens to be in charge of the class programming at one of the buildings where I work had decided that a little bit of new media and sort of technology would be a good thing to start offering. And so instead of traditional art classes, she was offering some programming classes, which of course excited me very much, because I've never had the opportunity to teach programming to anyone. And to be fair, until very recently, I don't think I would have been qualified to do that anyway. But I was, you know, something, teaching is something that I tend to be able to do fairly well, passably well. And so I kind of volunteered, and she kind of volunteered me for teaching these classes. And they were short classes. They weren't full courses. They're not college-level courses by any means. They're more like community-type classes that anyone can take, and there's no credit involved. It's for fun classes. Two of them were for kids. One of them was for teenagers. Of course, there's a preponderance of proprietary operating systems, both in this building that I was going to teach at and just sort of in the real world. So I decided, which probably doesn't surprise you, decided that I was going to teach the class on Linux. In order to do that, I figured I needed to come up with a system that I could put temporarily onto these computers that I would be using in this classroom, and I needed something standard and predictable. In other words, I wanted kind of one setup all across all the computers, so that I didn't run into versioning problems or you know, well, it doesn't work this way on this computer because it's compiled differently, or, you know, whatever. None of those unpleasant surprises. So I was kind of looking around at a possible solution for that, and I realized, because I had just done, at the time, I had just done the season finale of the previous GNU World Order season 8, where I was raving about Slacks. And so Slacks was very much on my mind, still is, actually. And so I decided, well, maybe I should try to do a class or two using Slacks as my environment. So I did a little bit of testing, a lot of Slacks module building, so that I would have the tools that I would need in class. And I discovered that it was probably going to work. And so, long story short, I started the teenage video game programming class, which was covering Python and Pygame. And it was a short course. It was only 3 hours a day for 5 days, so it was almost a little bit rushed, to be honest. And I covered Bash for like half of a class, just to get them started. And we did this interesting little dice rolling game, and then we did a version of that dice rolling game, which was procedural. We did a version of it then that turned that procedural application, or program, into an object-oriented program, or such as it can be on Bash. In other words, turning that into a function, and then calling the function at the end of your script, and then even embedding that function, or embedding within that function a loop that would continue to happen until something, you know, until the student, or the player, you know, wins, or whatever. So that was cool. And then we transitioned into Python, talked a little bit about Python, and then got into Pygame. And at the end of the course, they designed a very basic platformer, side-scrolling platformer game in Python. So that was a lot of fun. And it was all done on GNU Linux, Slacks. So here's how I did it on Slacks. It's pretty straightforward, but I should go ahead and mention some of the things that I did, just so you know. So Slacks, the computers that I was dealing with, unfortunately, could not boot off of thumb drive. The manufacturer of this particular brand of computers actually makes it so that you cannot boot off of thumb drives, which is really weird and stupid, but that's what we have. So, had to boot off a CD. Didn't want to run off a CD for obvious reasons. I mean, that would be slow. So, at the beginning of Slacks, when you first boot into the CD, you can hit the up or down arrow, or actually, I think any key, but I was using the up or down arrow, to get into a boot menu. And at the boot menu, you have a couple of choices, one of which is copy contents, or copy OS to RAM. And so I selected that, and continued the boot. And I booted with no mode set, just to keep things really simple. And you hit the tab key to get to the kernel arguments, just no mode set. So there's no graphic card issues. So booted all of the computers to Slacks. It copied Slacks to RAM. So the performance felt native, completely native. No one knew that the OS was not actually installed on the computer. It was just absolutely seamless. It felt like you were running Slacks on the computer. For the modules, the way that Slacks does modules, of course, is that it distributes the modules as little .sb packages. And these .sb, Slacks build, these .sb packages get mounted as SquashFS, I guess, file systems within the Slacks file system. So you mount, for instance, Stani's Python editor, SPE, and it just mounts itself into user bin, and all the libraries that it needs gets mounted into user USR lib or slash lib or whatever. I don't really know, but I mean, I should. I wrote the package, but or the Slacks build, but you get the idea. It just integrates it right itself right into the OS, which is really nice. So the thing about that is, I mean, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to just have the computers on all week. Turns out that I actually was able to. But even so, if someone had lost power or something like that, I wanted to have the modules available on hand so that we didn't have to go to the network all the time and re-download all the packages from slacks.org. That would be silly. So I put all the modules that we needed in class and then some on little tiny thumb drives. And when I say little tiny, I don't mean physical size. I mean they were like 256 megabyte thumb drives, which I just solicited. I sent out an email to everyone who works in the buildings and said, if you have old thumb drives that you have been meaning to throw away, bring them in. I can use them for this class. And so they did. So I had like 256 megabyte size thumb drives, which no one can use for anything, but it turns out that it can hold a bunch of little applications for Slacks. So I put a thumb drive in the back of each computer, booted into Slacks off the CD, and then used that thumb drive as the source for all of the applications, or all the important, you know, unique applications that they were going to be running. Now, the way that you do that, because Slacks has it built in so that when you do a Slacks activate Pygame, then it looks at that package, Pygame, and it wants to resolve the dependencies for you. And it'll even download the dependencies for you. But I didn't want that. I wanted everything to be used off of that thumb drive. So you essentially have to tell Slacks not to resolve dependencies and just to load everything in that folder on that thumb drive. So, because I resolved the dependencies myself. I made sure that if I put pygame.sb in my thumb drive, then I also had python.sb and sdl.sb and smpeg.sb. So I knew all the dependencies were there, and none of them are build dependencies, right? They're already built. They're binary packages. So we're just loading them into the file system. So if something's missing, it's not a big deal. It's going to appear in a minute anyway. So what I did was just issued a command right after boot. Yes, no, pipe, slacks, activate. Well, actually, I did a for I in asterisk dot sb semicolon. Yes, no, pipe, slacks, activate, $i, semicolon, done. That was the magical command that I issued on each computer. And what that did was it went through every match for any SB package in the folder on the thumb drive. And anytime it prompted me to download dependencies, it echoed no, because yes, no is just repeating the word no over and over and over again. So yes, no does that. So it prompts me to download a dependency. I answer no. It loads the application. And then it continues to the next one and onto the next one and to the next one until it has no more SB packages to process. So that worked beautifully. It loaded each package into the OS. It, you know, even if the dependency wasn't there, it didn't care. It just loaded it. And by the end, of course, all the dependencies were there. So everything worked like a charm. The students were able to bring their own thumb drives in to save all their work to the thumb drive. But otherwise, it was a self-contained little system that felt completely native and was running on hardware that really wanted to be running proprietary software and was not. And it just worked out perfectly. There was one computer that kept crashing. Everything was the same, so I knew it wasn't the software. As far as I could tell, that it had some kind of, I guess, a corruption in the RAM or something, because literally the thing that I did to fix the problem was unplug the computer, leave it unplugged overnight, so all the electricity and all the charge were completely gone, and in the morning I plugged it back in, rebooted it back into Slack, and it was fine from then on. I'd never really encountered anything like that before, but that was the solution, or at least after that, it was no longer a problem. So I don't know if you're an electrical engineer or something and that sounds right or wrong, let me know. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it. But that was, I tried everything else. I tried a bunch of special little snag keys at boot time. I mean, I tried everything I knew to try and it just kept crashing. I even tried an OS that wasn't Slacks. It was a Fedora live CD from one of the magazines, and that also crashed. So it wasn't anything having to do with that environment. It was the computer for sure. I just don't, and from QA testing, I knew that sometimes, you know, actually removing all the power from the thing was a good idea. So I did that and it did fix the problem. Not really sure what that's all about. And certainly I've never seen that on any other computer except this particular brand of computer. And I have seen it before on that brand of computer. So I don't know if there's some kind of special caching that this brand of computer is doing or if it's a kind of RAM. I don't know. But that did fix it. So if that happens to you ever, try it. It might work. So anyway, Slacks, what can I say about using Slacks for real for not just 3 hours a day for 5 days a week, because then I had two other classes, week-long classes, for kids that I was teaching. So that was like, what, 6 or 8, something crazy like that, hours for 5 days? A long time. Long time to be living in Linux, in real life, you know, under pressure, people expecting great things, not expecting crashes or hang-ups or problems or unforeseen issues. And I have to say, it was brilliant. Everything worked exactly as you could want it to work. I mean, it was a sublime experience. It was just fantastic. I have no complaints about it. I feel like I should be raving about it even more, but I mean, honestly, it's difficult to do that because the point is that it worked. It just, you know, I mean, we all run Linux. If you're listening to this show, you probably run Linux. So it's not really a surprise that it ran. it worked. Now, the cool part, I guess, one thing, I mean, certainly I'm glad it didn't let me down. I mean, that would have been very heartbreaking for me. That would have been bad. And it's always scary when you're trying something new. You know, you've never taught a whole week-long or 3-week-long or 2-week-long class on this system. So there's a little bit of apprehension because now there's this, you know, the ever-present curse of now it actually matters. So what's going to happen? Kind of like when you're doing a technical talk at a conference or something, you know, you just know that during your live demo, something that you've never, ever seen happen is going to suddenly happen, and you have no idea why, and people are going to be staring at you, and it's going to be one of those dreams or something. Bad dreams, nightmares. But more importantly, I think, was the fact that the students themselves didn't really even look twice at the operating system. It wasn't like there was never a moment where someone said, you know, why are we learning it on this operating system, or what is this thing that I'm looking at? I mean, half of them, of course, didn't even know that they weren't looking at a proprietary system. They didn't, it just completely over their head. But the other half did seem cognizant that this is not something that they know, but they weren't afraid to learn something new. And I'm sure that it helps that it's a classroom environment, number one, and number two, that it's something where they're learning something that Linux is traditionally aimed at, like programming and Linux are great bedfellows. They go together really, really well. People don't question the fact that, hey, I'm going to teach you some programming, and here's your Linux computer for that lesson. That seems very natural, I think. So I think that that's possibly part of the reason for that is simply because, yeah, they traditionally they do go together pretty well. So the point there is that if you are ever in a position where you're teaching someone anything having to do with computery geeky stuff, so if you're teaching someone HTML and CSS and JavaScript, or if you're teaching someone Python or anything like that, then one of the things that I think you can absolutely get away with without question is firing up a Slacks instance and saying, well, if I'm going to teach you this stuff, we really ought to be using Linux because of some reasons. And people just don't question it. I mean, that's the area where they can't really necessarily argue against using Linux. The argument could even be made, well, you should develop on the platform it's going to be running upon, and 9 times out of 10, the platform that an internet website is going to be running on is Linux. So learning it on that platform is something that you can, I think, totally get away with. I think there's also an unrecognized value in teaching people something that is completely new to them and not a replacement for them. So in other words, a lot of people have already learned Microsoft Office in school or on the job. And showing them OpenOffice is always going to be, or LibreOffice, or whatever, AbbeyWord, it's always going to be compared to what they already know. Heck, you could say the same thing of the operating system itself, right? If they've already learned one operating system and now you're showing them Linux as a desktop operating system, then it's based upon what they've already seen. And everything that's different is a bad thing, and everything that's better is maybe nice, but it's still so weird, and I'm not really used to it, blah, blah, blah. So teaching someone something completely new and saying, well, this is the way I know to do it, so here's how you can do that, it makes things a lot easier. And I've already had that experience with people who have no experience with Photoshop, for instance, showing them GIMP, because that's what I know, and that's what I'm going to teach them on, and there's no reason to learn anything else. And if they want to learn Photoshop, then they can learn that somewhere else, but if they're coming to me for help, then they're going to learn it on GIMP, because that's what I know, and since they don't know any different, they don't really necessarily argue about it anyway. Not always true. Obviously, some people know the name Photoshop enough, and they know that it's, you know, it's magical, so they really want to be learning that. But more often than not, I found that teaching someone with no prior experience things on Linux is a lot easier than teaching people with prior expectations and things that they think they know, and there's this idea that yes, you are showing them a replacement or an alternative to, and that's a lot harder to pass off. So seize those opportunities where you're teaching people completely new things and boot to Slacks and show them on Slacks. Now, of course, anytime that you are teaching people new things and you are trying to impress them with these new things, teaching them on a platform that you're not familiar with is obviously very dangerous, and that's what makes Slacks particularly perfect for me, because it really is, I mean, it's basically the live CD of Slackware. I mean, it's not. If you ask the Slackware people, they'll tell you Slacks is not Slackware. And they're right, it's not. It's different. But in terms of similarity versus differences, it's a lot more similar to Slackware than it is dissimilar. And now that I've built quite a few modules, mainly for my classes, I'm pretty familiar with it. And I have it on a thumb drive. I paid the $25. I got the little metal Slacks thumb drive, so I use it fairly regularly, and I feel very comfortable in it, and it doesn't take me by surprise. If you're not used to Slacks, probably booting up to it and trying to teach people things on it is probably not the best idea ever. That's a little bit dangerous, but I'm familiar with it. I feel comfortable on it, and booting to that and teaching people how to use GIMP or how to use, or, you know, how to type HTML and CSS and then mount their server in their file system in Dolphin and just uploading it that way. I mean, this is stuff that people get impressed about really easily. These are killer features of Linux. And for my programming class, Kate actually was a big killer feature. I didn't mean for Kate to be a killer feature, but people really took to Kate because that's what I had them using at first before we got into Stanley's Python editor. But they really liked Kate. I mean, line numbering and syntax highlighting, and it just very kind of familiar notepad kind of text editing feel with lots of cool extra programming features. And they asked, I mean, one of the questions was, can we get Kate for computers at home? And I said, no, you can't. But at the end of the class, you can take a Slax CD, and I showed them how to reboot computers on two different kinds of computers, one a very specialized proprietary system and one a more generic proprietary system, rebooted, showed them how to get into BIOS or EFI or something that EFI is a front into, and how to select their boot disk and all this other stuff, and told them, this is how you can do it. You load it to RAM, do this, get your, here's your thumb drive, and at the end of the class I gave them a thumb drive. Well, they brought in their own thumb drives, and I copied to their thumb drives all the Slax modules that they would ever need for continuing what I taught them in class. I gave them native applications for their OS as well, in some cases where they were available. I gave them links to different resources on the programming languages and to Linux information, and sent them home with a Slax CD so that they could boot to it if they really wanted to. Some people won't. Some people will. And that's all you can do, right? So, Slax, a sublimely functional, great little performing boot CD that you can use for quick, on-the-go lessons about pretty much anything that Slax has available that you want to show people. It's just absolutely ideal for those people who know nothing about a subject. You're going to teach them, so you reboot into Linux and you teach them. It's as easy as that. If you're ever in that position, go for it. Feel completely confident in your ability to teach on Linux using the Slax Pocket OS. One more thing about Slax, really cool, really just kind of a geeky cool thing. Think about it. Slax, 216 megabytes, complete OS. I mean, enough of an OS that it fits into the RAM of like a 5-year-old computer and then leaves some RAM for actually, you know, operating within and works like it's a native app. I mean, it's a native installed OS. It's just so cool. Looking out at the students on these computers, like again, like 5 or 6-year-old computers running off of RAM, an entire OS with all the basic tools that they would ever need, plus a few that I added off the thumb drives. It was a truly wonderful experience to witness and to experience. It was great. 216 megabytes. Amazing. Okay, time for coffee. Let's go get some coffee, and we'll come back and we'll keep talking about how to get Linux and GNU and all this other stuff out into the world. Related somewhat to the whole Slax thing is the use of Linux in other classes, which I have slowly started to roll out in filmmaking classes. I've been demonstrating stuff on Fedora for a while in some of my classes and some other stuff on Slackware, but actually having the students sit down and use the stuff that I was demonstrating not always was a possibility. It kind of depended on the size of the class and the availability of the computers and stuff like that. Recently we've been doing overhauls on a lot of the editing systems here, and certainly, you know, a terabyte, 2 terabytes has been dedicated to a proprietary operating system, but since there are spare drive bays, I figured in a lot of these things I would pop a spare 250 gig hard drive and dedicate it to a Linux operating environment. It was a tough call as to what I would dedicate it to, and I'm still kind of exploring the different like options and sort of the best path to take. But I did want to actually steer a little bit away from KDE, which is weird to hear me say. It's weird for me to hear me say that. But KDE is widely regarded as a complex operating environment, and I think it's totally possible to simplify it, and it's certainly possible to skin it so that it looks different than how it normally looks and all this other stuff. But I just decided that the nice, slick interface of Fedora was too much to resist. So I tried installing Fedora onto about 6 different high-end editing suites, and no, 8. 8 high-end editing suites, and I just dumped a bunch of audio and video editing software onto the systems, obviously tried it out and made sure everything was working as expected, and then replicated that across all eight systems. So Fedora, in retrospect, probably was not the best solution because it is a moving target. I knew that when I was doing it, and I just did it anyway. And probably in the future, if you know, as I refine all of this, I'll probably look into CentOS or possibly Red Hat with an academic license. I don't know. But I mean, I wanted the extra packages. That's the real goal, was to get away from the enterprise-y feeling of of the system and make it into an audio video system. And I have to say, I mean, it's been working out really nicely. One of the key applications that I wanted on there for my classes was FlowBlade. FlowBlade it's a very sort of strict and structured video editing application. It's not freewheeling like OpenShot or Kdenlive. Live. It's very much about, this is your clip, this is the time code at which the clip occurs, this is, you know, you need to respect the time code and stuff like that. And that's a very traditional kind of filmic way of editing, which is good for many reasons. Because if you're doing fancy offline editing, then you need to know that stuff. And you need to actually know where your footage comes from. And that when you swap out your footage with the offline footage, when you bring your footage online, is what I'm trying to say, to your higher res footage, you need to know that everything's going to match up correctly. And you can't do that quite as effectively with a freewheeling, crazy video editing system where you don't really pay attention to any of that stuff and you don't keep time codes and, you know, all this other stuff. So it's a good practice to get into, and it certainly prepares people a lot more. I mean, FlowBlade would prepare people a lot more for the structured editing practices of most large editing houses. So that's kind of an important principle, and it's a free application. It's Python MLT. It's really nice. My friend Reggie actually told me about it. I hadn't even heard of it, and now it's like really, it's a program that I really like and that I can really appreciate. Did an RPM, built an RPM for that, loaded it onto all the systems, and then just made sure that all the other extra stuff, you know, Blender and GIMP and all that other stuff was there. My point, and yes, I do have one, is that, well, it's multi-level, and this is from a systems administrator's viewpoint, I guess. And it is that when I was trying to image these computers with the proprietary OS, it literally took at least 2 hours, but I think in real life I would say 3 hours per system to correctly image each machine. There are lots of reasons. I'm not going to go into them because they're boring and they're proprietary and we don't care. But for the Fedora systems, it was as simple as installing the Fedora system, running a setup script, and I could have done it probably with Kickstart file, from within Anaconda, but I didn't. I just ran a setup script, and that was it. It installed everything that I needed in less than an hour, and the thing was up and running. I mean, so, in other words, I got 3 suites done on Fedora to every 1 suite done on the proprietary system. And this is using proprietary systems tools, their approved method of cloning this thing, 2 to 3 hours. Fedora, less than an hour. It was pretty astonishing. There's also an amazing size difference. The image of the proprietary system with all the stuff that needed to be installed was about 75 gigs. To be fair, about 40 of that was extra content that ships with some of these applications. So we could even say 35 gigs, although that's not correct, but we could say it. Heck, we could even say 20 gigs if you want. It doesn't matter to me. The image for Fedora was about, well, it was less than 4 gigs, and that's for as many multimedia applications as you could possibly imagine. It was the size difference was just staggering. I mean, really staggering. I was running out of room on the proprietary system. I mean, I had no place to put these images after a while. I literally had to get a new thumb drive for all the applications that were going to be installed. The Fedora one, it all fit on, like, well, certainly on a 16 gig thumb drive, which I had lying around, and I didn't even need that much. I mean, that was overkill. So the size difference and the time difference, just it's astonishing, really. And the proprietary system, I mean, the 3 hours per suite was just to get the image on the machines. I mean, before that, there were 2 days of going through the system and getting, like, that master image kind of configured and perfected so that when I duplicated it across the systems, everything would be correct. So, I mean, it was 3 hours of actual time plus 2 days of setup time. And the Fedora system, I mean, it just kind of, like, came to me, oh, I should put that on an extra drive and pop it into each machine. And it was just, I mean, I did it in an afternoon. I wrote the setup script and configured everything. I mean, there were a couple of false starts. There were a couple of times where my setup script had some stupid error in it and that I had to you know, do it by hand, but mainly, I mean, it was basically maybe a day at the most setup time, and then like 8 hours of install time, compared to 2 days, and 8 times 3 is 24, so like three solid days of installing. I mean, it's just, and I'm not talking about work days, I'm talking about 3 days. I mean, it took forever. I can't emphasize the how unpleasant it is to maintain these proprietary systems. It's almost amazing. Like, I guess that's the classic manager versus sysadmin view of the world, right? I mean, if a sysadmin was managing, or was truly managing the infrastructure and the technology used in the organization, it would be a completely different story, I think, because it would have to be, because these proprietary systems are nearly unmaintainable. I mean, they're just, you're not maintaining anything. You're just kind of, you're keeping things from falling apart. It's just, it's a disaster. And the mind boggles to try to understand why we're not using a maintainable Linux system. It's just the difference is overwhelming. You could say it wasn't even the difference between free software and proprietary software if you wanted to, except that actually, I mean, it is, but it's not, I mean, where it's not, but it is. But I mean, the proprietary systems just don't let you do what you need to do. You know, like you see how certain things could be made better on these proprietary systems. And believe me, I have uncovered commands you don't even know exist on these proprietary systems. I mean, I know DSCL, I know disk util, I know these commands that you do not know, HDI util. I know the flags. I know how to install these things with options that again, you don't even know about, and nobody on these proprietary systems knows about, except some people who do. But I'm trying to say that I'm not using the standard tools. I'm using like tools that are meant, I guess, to make this system more flexible, and yet they just don't go far enough. And I don't know if it's because they just never thought of it, or if they're just doing it because they don't feel that that's the market share, or what, or like the what their users want. I don't know, but they're just not making it sysadmin or whatever you want to call it, the IT department or the computer guy friendly. They're just not making it friendly, and Linux does that. They allow for that, and it's the difference is night and day. So truly, if you have the choice, if you're in a position where you've got that choice, don't be fooled. The proprietary systems will screw you every single time. Kind of preaching to the choir, though. I mean, if you're listening to this show, you're probably okay with free software. I don't know if you think that free software needs to be everywhere, and that there's, you know, never an excuse to use non-free software. I don't, or did I just use a double negative? I don't know. But, you know, I'm not sure where you are on that. And I guess on some days I'm not sure where I am on that. I think the overall truism of, okay, when do I resort to free software? Resort to free software. When is it okay to go free software staunchly? Is, you know, are you ready to go to free software? And that's been something that truly I think is dangerous for a lot of us enthusiasts, is that we see that free software offers some solution and we want to jump into it because we're all about the free software. But if we ourselves are not properly trained on that software yet, we don't know the needs of the users, we don't know how to make that happen, even if it's a workaround, if we don't know that we need that workaround or how to make that workaround happen, then it's going to fail, and you're setting it up to fail because you're not ready for that yet. So, you know, jumping the gun, being overzealous is a danger, but at the same time there's that other extreme of wondering whether free software can actually handle something. 9 times out of 10 it can. Whether or not the users can handle something, that's a completely different story, and unfortunately it's probably I don't know how to deal with that necessarily, other than just telling people this is what you're going to do. But I mean, that usually requires some kind of managerial decree, and if you're not in that position, then that's probably not going to happen. But certainly from the perspective of your freedom to do stuff, I mean, the free software, not surprisingly, pretty much wins. But I guess the thing that really got me thinking about all of this anyway, I mean, in addition to the fact that I was using Slacks in a live environment to teach people new stuff on computers and loving every minute of it, was that I read the Free Isn't Freedom book. It's a book by Sam Williams, I think is the guy's name. And this is the version 2.0 version, so, or the edition, the 2.0 edition, which was actually edited by Richard Stallman. So Free Isn't Freedom bills itself sort of as a, I guess, a biography of Richard Stallman and the free software movement. And the "and" there is very important, because it's not a biography of Richard Stallman. There are a couple of passages in it that read like a biography, and I don't actually like biographies. So when I picked this book up, I think I got it from the FSF book at Usenix, 2011. I kind of cracked it open, and I read some passages that just really felt like a biography, and I actually kind of put the book down for a long time after that. But recently I was browsing through it again, and I was getting into like the really techie parts of it, and I thought, wow, maybe this book isn't so bad after all. So I read it from cover to cover this time, and it's really, really good. Highly recommend it. If you can get a copy, it's on the FSF site. You can purchase a copy. It's well worth the read. For a lot of different reasons. I mean, the biography parts aren't very interesting to me, really. They are a little bit. There was one part, for instance, that they were saying that RMS probably, like, has a little bit of Asperger's or something like that on the spectrum, as they say. But just didn't, no one, people weren't saying that when he was born, you know what I mean? Like, unique character traits, and they weren't putting them into fancy terms like, oh, it's on this spectrum of whatever. It was just, what's wrong with that kid, you know? So most of the biography part was not very interesting, but the technology part, like the history about the MIT artificial intelligence lab and kind of the culture there, all of this stuff, really, really interesting. And it really brings into question and kind of brings up these interesting issues, such as the need that many people feel for corporate validation versus freedom, for instance. And that's a really, really kind of sneaky thing that I think a lot of us don't even really, we're not cognizant of. Like, a lot of people feel, including, you know, a lot of us, I think, we feel the need to have some sense of well, we're okay because a corporation says we're okay. And that's a very easy thing to get into because, first of all, we're conditioned, I think, to think that things that are very in our face and on the television and on in the subway walls and at the bus stop advertising slots, you know, those are the real things in life. Those are actually important, and the other things that no one else has heard of are less important. So that's an easy one to fall into, and I think that it plays upon also the fear that we may have that software freedom or freedom in general, freedom, will not sustain our activities, and that we need a corporation to kind of protect us from sort of the waning of whatever. So in other words, sure, we have the Linux kernel now, and sure, we have GCC and GDB and Emacs now, but what if the developer leading that loses interest? Like, what if the project just kind of stops to, you know, it loses traction? Well, if we have a corporation backing it, then we've got a guarantee that project will continue to live. And really, when the opposite is true. I mean, maybe they're equal, you know, maybe, I mean, a developer losing interest, all developers everywhere losing interest in something is about as likely, maybe, possibly less, as, you know, a corporation saying, we're not going to do this program anymore. And, I mean, you need look no further than, well, there are lots of famous and some very recent examples of very big computer companies changing or stopping completely, you know, some very sort of well-loved software that people had just kind of gotten used to. They'd maybe even grown up with it or, you know, grown into adulthood with it, and now it suddenly had completely changed. And there's just not that much, there's really not anything that the corporations bring to software that guarantees anything against that. So it's silly to feel like, oh, well, we need corporate validation in order for this to continue, because otherwise we're just riding on the whims of a couple of developers, and really you're not. You know, you've got the source code, you have ownership of it. You could build a corporation around it in some, you know, in the future if you wanted to. You could, if someone lost interest in it, you can hire people to work on the code. I mean, the possibilities are a lot more endless there than a corporation deciding, eh, we're not going to do that anymore. We're taking our code and we're just going to lock it away, and we're not going to listen to your requests for change. So the thing that the book doesn't mention all that much, but it really, really made me think about, was the idea of consumerism versus production, or producerism. And this is an important concept, I think, that it's been around, you know, for a very long time, obviously, and the book does go into the fact that at MIT Lab, before the corporate personal computer revolution even was there, the software was a free thing. I mean, it was taken for granted that you had access to the source code for everything that you were running on your computer. And it was really something that started to develop later as people started, you know, they just kind of decided, we're going to sell software, we're going to make this into a business and stuff like that. It was something that happened, yeah, much later, when people to stop distributing the source code along with the applications. So really, that was the natural state of, you know, this quote open source or this free software thing was the natural state, and it was much more the bastardization of that natural state of things that led to really what the reality is now, which is, you know, the proprietary code. But what they don't really say in the exact words, I guess, that I wanted to hear was they weren't talking really about the DIY movement or the make movement. The make, quote unquote, make movement is really big right now, at least where I am. I don't know if it's all over the place with you, but like, I hear about the maker movement all the time, and it's really funny because it seems so important, and yet it seems so not cannibalistic, but it seems to really not be. I mean, it's a maker movement, and you're encouraging people to make things and to repair things and to reuse and to recycle and stuff like that. But it's not self-supportive. It's not self-sustaining. Like, even though they're encouraging people to make stuff, they're not encouraging people to make their own tools that will then enable them to make stuff. You know, it's a consumer-oriented making movement. It's like, buy all of this stuff and then start making, instead of, I mean, they don't say it that way, but it is kind of implied, because the tool set that you use to make your stuff is not free. So you must be consuming, you're a consumer at some point, and then you're making. So that's kind of something that always kind of bugs me in the back of my mind. You know, I'm just thinking, yes, you're saying you want people to make and to produce, but you're not pointing out to them that there would be no production if it wasn't for the fact that someone else was making this tool for them. And I understand that that's kind of a fractalian problem. I mean, you can't. I mean, how deep, how far back can you go before you just completely lose your mind? Because then you're like, well, I haven't made my own molecules. You know, it's kind of like, it's a dangerous road to go down, and yet at the same time there is a certain pragmatic thing about it, where part of the lesson about consumerism versus production and making your own things is that the tools that you're using should be as independent as possible as well. I mean, that's the question. That's the question I think that it's all going to boil down to, I hope, at some point. People are going to have to start asking, I hope, do we want people to start thinking for themselves and to produce new ideas and progressive technology and producing, you know, what they want to do and producing things that are useful for them? Or are we really just breeding a bunch of consumers? And that, in a big way, is exactly what GNU Linux is all about, Charlie Brown. It's about producing things instead of just being the consumer. And for me, that really is a lot of what it's all about. And there was a Richard Stallman video that I happened to see. It came bundled on a Linux Format magazine, DVD actually. And it was him talking at, you know, some place. And he opened up with sort of posing a question, is living in a digital society a good thing? Because it's usually posed as, you know, just a positive thing. It's not really questioned. It's just assumed that we're all perfectly happy and excited about living in a digital society. Everything's on computers, and, you know, we've got all this technology, so it must be a good thing, right? We're in the future. But, you know, when I was a kid growing up with sci-fi, one of the things that that was assumed then was that in sci-fi, the technology was there because it was making life better. Like, that was the justification for technology. And that the time when technology was evil, like Skynet or something, was when it started making life worse, you know, when it started taking over the quality of life, making it a bad thing. And it seems like today we don't really even ask the question. It's just like, it is just kind of assumed, oh, technology, yeah, life is so much better because of technology. And I'm not sure that that's exactly correct. I don't know that that's a true statement. I don't know if that's something that we actually can take for granted. And it seems like someone needs to be asking that question. Is the technology that we are producing actually improving the quality of life, or is it just adding to the noise, signal-to-noise ratio, adding to the noise side? And that's an important thing to ask, because I don't think that all of this stuff should be sustained just because it's technology. The idea that it is good because it's technology is something that I think a lot of people use for a lot of different arguments, including the free software one. You know, we can't use the free software version of this software. We can't start relying on free software because this proprietary system exists. Well, why does it exist? It's not making your life better. It's actually complicating your life because it's taking your data and it's changing on you and it's forcing you to upgrade constantly, etc., etc. But it's just kind of taken for granted. Well, it's better because it exists. And that's just not necessarily the case. Now, how to get other people to see that, I really don't know. But it's just something that the book kind of made me really, really think about and kind of realize that this other technology, or that the technology is not necessarily a good thing that really you necessarily want to even take part in. And that, for me, is exactly the answer to kind of like the question of GNU. Like, is it relevant? Is it necessary? Is it important? Is it something that we want to contribute to? The answer is like a resounding yes, because GNU, the term GNU, means that we want to have our source code and we want to keep it. And there are other systems out there that let you have the source code, but then other people can walk away with it and change it out from under you. And then the GNU stuff, it protects our interests as people. You know, we have access to every level, mostly, of the tool set that we use to be producers. And that's really, really important. And I think that the GNU label is something that needs to, I don't know that it needs to be prepended to the whole, you know, the GNU Linux thing. I don't know that it's a necessary label. There was a discussion about that in the book, and amazingly, I was actually not sold on the idea. I was actually less sold by the end of that discussion than I was before it. You know, the GNU label is what it is. GNU is what it is. Linux is what it is. And saying that Linux would be nowhere without GNU may or may not be true. I don't know. They could have adapted the BSD utilities for the Linux system, for all I know. I don't really know a lot about that stuff. I do know that it would be possible to have a Linux system without the GNU utilities, so it's not really fair, I don't think, to say that you have to say GNU Linux. I do not see that, and I see GNU as a separate thing, but a very, very important thing. And the fact that it doesn't have the mind share that Linux does is significant, and it's kind of dangerous, and I think that the GNU label and everything that it means, like the actual free software side of things, the activism for not the activism itself, but being able to stand up for putting humans before computers, or putting human interests before technology, that's really important. And resisting the mindless and steady and constant need to upgrade and need to update and must buy more, faster, better computers, I think GNU stands, for me at least, very much as a resistance to that. And that's really, really an important principle, I think, to grab hold of and promote. And I don't know that Linux necessarily represents that, you know? I mean, Linux represents a lot of great things. I mean, like, a lot of great things. But GNU, for me at least, it kind of represents that sort of resistance to the mindless march of what they call progress. And I'm not convinced at all that it's progress. Cell phones, to me, are not progress. Cure for cancer? That would be progress. Cell phones in your pockets? Not so much. So yeah, it's a resistance to this onward march forward into, like, more technology must be better, and recognizing that that's not something that you can just say without qualification. You cannot say that kind of thing without explaining why it's better and justifying why you need that kind of technology now, and you cannot wait for a free version of it, or you can't wait till a code has been examined and has been made to be human-friendly rather than just corporate friendly. So that's my thoughts on freeze and freedom, I guess, and it's my thoughts on the whole GNU issue, and I think it's very important. And I mean, check out some of those videos. The DNS versus GNS issue was fascinating. I mean, really, really fascinating stuff that it just makes you realize that GNU is out there to create really an alternative space for people who are interested in technology for humans' sake rather than technology for technology's sake. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
The murderer. Now I know it, Travis. How could you?